This is an ESO and Dude Letter production. Welcome to Mission Briefing.
Hello and welcome to Mission Briefing. This is part of the Dude Letter Podcasting Network and spin-off of Myopia. I'm your host, John Copsey, and with me on panel are...
Nick Hoffman, executive producer of Dude Letter Podcasting and host of Myopia Defend Your Childhood. You'd think I would be better at saying it since I say it fucking three times a week.
Hello, this is Daniel. I am the host of the upcoming Disremembered podcast, and I am a frequent contributor slash annoyance to Nick on Myopia.
And much more professional than I was. Well done, sir.
Yeah, it goes to show just what he's learned and what you have yet to do, Nick.
Ooh. And with that, Mission Briefing has just been canceled.
Oh, no, it's my first time. But this is the first time with me as the host of Mission Briefing, and we hope to have plenty more where this will be fun and exciting and delving into new things since we no longer have our fun movies. So we have to get a little creative. And so this week, we will delve into the sometimes rocky world of Bond theme songs.
Mr. Copsey, shall I cue the music?
Please do. Welcome to Mission Briefing. Everyone has their favorite songs, and we also have some that we wish had never been made. And so we will discuss some of our favorite theme songs and why, along with our least favorites, with maybe a guilty pleasure or two thrown in. So there are definitely some that are near the top for just about everybody. Goldfinger and License to Kill. Not License to Kill. What's that other one? Live and Let Die, that one, yeah. Obviously near my top 10 list. But there are also some that we wish had never been made. So we'll go through all that as we go. So let's kick it off then. Daniel, your number 5 movie or theme song was...
The number 5 theme song, okay. My number 5 was the movie's crap, but the song was awesome. Duran Duran's A View to a Kill.
Because the 80s can never die, right?
Absolutely. Well, first, that was, I think, the one time at least the first time, it might still be the only time that a Bond theme ever hit number 1 on the charts, which means that after 20-some-odd years of Bond films... It was finally the songs that were as much of an event as the movies themselves were.
This was the first time a theme song made it to the top number 1 in the charts?
That's my understanding, yes.
So I have a question for you, then, Daniel. Which comes first, then? Is this an effect, do you think? This is you as pop dose, right?
Yeah.
This is you as film person. Is this more because of this is the MTV era? Or is this more because this is the Roger Moore era? This is like the poppy era. And looking at the charts, we have a lot of pop songs effectively on here. So is this because Roger Moore and everything lines up perfectly with MTV, do you think?
I don't know, because the film was incredibly goofy and it didn't really seem to take too many cues from that MTV aesthetic. Plus, I mean, there were already some big pop stars that had recorded for Bond films at the time, even in the 80s. I mean, Sheena Easton recorded For Your Eyes Only, right.
Yeah.
So I don't know what it is. It could very well be that, Aha, which had one of the most famous music videos ever, recorded the next Bond theme.
Right.
So I don't know what it was about this one in particular. I think you're right, though, that it sets the poppy tone that A View to a Kill really had.
Definitely. And it's interesting. It's noteworthy that Bond and the theme songs and all that, they predate music videos by and large, or what we would consider now music videos. And it's almost a reversal when you get to the MTV era. That it seems like it's the bands that were big in the music video world who ended up getting some of the theme songs, like Aha and Duran Duran.
Sure. Yeah, no, and, it's just, it's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, and yet the intros, they definitely got more slick and more of a part of the movies, but they never quite passed that gulf into pure music video, did they?
No. And I will say, you know, even this one, which hopefully you guys can hear behind, it still has those John Barry trumpets that you get from Goldfinger, right? Dun, 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 dun. And yeah. So, like, it is reaching back to the Bond. And, like, I mean, obviously Duran Duran is all electronica. So when you listen to it in person, they don't do that. So it's an interesting tug in this era. Even the movie is very goofy. Yeah, but, you know, John's in charge now. But hopefully we'll revisit some of these in a different context. But having re-seen the movie recently, it is very silly. And so this is probably the most gritty part of the whole thing.
Probably. I remember there being a lot of skulls in the opening. Am I right on that front?
You are.
I think you are. Okay.
And I mean, this is in the era when they have nothing going for them, so it might as well be a Whitesnake video anyway.
Pretty much. I do challenge the idea, maybe not at this time, but the later intros, especially in the Brosnan area, did really become music videos. They're pretty decent standalone things. Especially the GoldenEye theme and the Tomorrow Never Dies theme.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, they're definitely... The production value went up significantly, and they became more of an integral part of the movie. So, obviously, like, the last one we did was Spectre, and there were the Spectre themes, the tendrils, the octopus, all throughout the entire thing. And same thing with GoldenEye. You had the Soviet-era things going on.
I hated the Spectre song, though, and the opening. That was terrible.
I don't
know what it was. It went on too long, I guess, and I don't think the song was really that good, and it didn't really set the tone for the film.
I disagree. It was a funky song for the film, and some of the songs are definitely better than the films, as we just said, and... Some of the films are better than the songs, because some of these people on the list, like Lulu, she almost is unheard of here in America. And I actually looked her up, because I remember my dad, of all people, saying he was a big fan of her in the 60s. And I looked her up, and she did To Sir With Love, and that was her only other hit. And that was in the same year, or about the same year as this, or as the movie she did.
As you can hear in the background, yeah.
Yeah, that's Lulu was a that was a tough song though to get through.
Well, here's the thing: it's perfectly appropriate for the goofiness of the movie.
Yeah, Man with the Golden Gun is a goofy movie.
I enjoy it very much, but it is a silly, silly movie.
There's no reason to knock a goofy movie right now.
Which was a better movie than Man with the Golden Gun in hindsight?
Hey, fuck you. I mean, well. I like them both. Don't make me choose between my children. Let's do the next song, man. Come on, we got at least 10 of them.
Yeah, so Nick, what's your number 5?
Well, if I look at the list I sent you, because these fluctuate a lot, I chose The Living Daylights, and I mean, it links back to a lot of what we literally were just saying, because this is AHA. And so it's poppy, it's flashy, I think the hook, in my mind, barely edges out of You to a Kill. But I'll be honest to you, you know, there's 26 of these. Well, there's technically 25, including Never Say Never Again. We added the Louis Armstrong, We Have All the Time in the World, part of the movie, kind of like how Disney adds, like, the pop version. So we had 26 to choose from. This one, I believe, was 7, so it just barely got bumped out of my top 5. I like this song because not only does it have a good hook to me, but it feels kind of poppy and sexy, not unlike Duran Duran's song, but it feels like the kind of thing that would play at an 80s night. You know, when I was in college, that was the hit thing. And for me, this feels kind of sultry. The Duran Duran song from A View to a Kill was, I think, number 7 overall for me. So it's just right there. But this is the one that beat it out just barely. I think Living Daylights is kind of more fun.
All right, fair enough. I mean, it's definitely got that 80s pop going on, and it's more bouncy than a lot of others. Like, it's not really sultry, I wouldn't think. It's bouncy. It's poppy.
Living Daylights!
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It's I mean, again, I think you're right. The proper comparison is Daniel's song, the Duran Duran Due to a Kill song. Yeah. Because it is, it's in that era where they're using pop's acts. It's just A-ha was out of their, the height of their popularity. So it's kind of interesting that they were chosen. So
that
kind
of sums up a lot of the Bond theme people, yeah, doesn't it?
It does. So John, what's your number five? Speaking of out of date, what are you? What's your number five?
Oh, my number five is Skyfall by Adele.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah.
That's not bad.
I like the song. Yeah, it was a throwback to the classics, like the Shirley Bassey types, and Adele was a perfect choice for it, since she's essentially a modern 60s singer. And it had a good theme, it had a good hook, the lyrics were even good, and it's one of those ones that sticks around.
Didn't they hire Adele to do that theme before she really broke big in the U.S.?
It's fully possible. I don't know.
I think 19 had come out, but 21 came out maybe earlier that year or the same year, so she might have, yeah. I mean, and I'll jump in here, John, because it's my number four. I like this song a lot because I think she is hopefully going to be the next Shirley Bassey for these, and they bring her back because she has that brassy voice. It's not just that it's a low voice for a woman, it's that it's almost harsh at times. It's brassy, and I think it's perfect. And I think it's not hurt by the fact that looking back on this movie, it's a good movie, but I think it's improved by the fact that the imagery of the song is good. Everything about it is solid, and she just really belts. Like, she really sings from the diaphragm and pushes this song.
She really does. And is that something you think might actually happen, that they'll do a Shirley Bassey while they'll bring recurring artists back? It seems like they've moved away from that.
I kind of doubt that they'll do that at this point, partly because it'd be very expensive to bring some of them back, especially somebody like Adele. The other part of it is I just think they really want to keep up with modern trends. And the thing about pop music is it's very disposable.
That's very true. And definitely in the early years of Bond, they stuck with that Frank Sinatra-style Goldfinger lounge music almost for the themes. And since Roger Moore, they've definitely moved into a it changes with the times.
My only argument against Daniel, because, you know, if I don't argue against Daniel, who will? Goldfinger came out in 64, and I believe Shirley Bassey, what was Bassey's last one? I thought it was Moonraker. Is that right?
Yeah, probably Moonraker, yeah.
That's 79, so that means there were 15 years in between, and by Moonraker, they're doing more poppy stuff. So I'm not saying you're wrong, Daniel, because, I mean, frankly, you may be right. We haven't had a repeat since, although the same writer has come back more than once, and, you know, other people have performed their songs. I find it charming because she has the kind of voice we want, which is something – I don't know, maybe one of you chose it, but Alanis Morissette, oh God, Sheryl Crow, for Tomorrow Never Dies. The song isn't great, but I do like that kind of deeper woman's voice, which makes it seem, like you said, kind of Sinatra-y, but at least Skyfall didn't feel to me like a Sinatra song. It just had the right range. You know?
Exactly. It was definitely a callback to the early Bonds while moving it forward.
When I first heard Adele was doing the theme to a Bond song, I'm like, that's so simple, it's genius in a way, yeah, for exactly the reasons you're saying, because it's the perfect throwback.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. So I was impressed when they picked her, and I've been impressed with her stuff overall. She's got a hell of a range, yeah, and she's, like, the first time I heard her, I thought, oh, she'd be good in Bond. And, yeah. I mean, well, the first time I heard her, I thought she was a black woman, because, damn, can she sing?
Yeah.
Imagine my surprise when she was an English white woman.
Yeah, no, it's
milk dust. That's the Amy Winehouse effect.
Yeah.
Yeah, really.
Well, and wasn't she the one who was supposed to do the one that they ended up getting Jack White and Alicia Keys for, and then she died?
Amy Winehouse? She would have been great. Yes, she would have been fantastic.
That's right.
And it's something about the blues, right? Like,
yeah.
It's not just that you imagine her singing in a lounge somewhere on top of a piano. It's that you know, effectively, and we can get into this later, but there's only so many different styles of Bond song, right? It's talking about how great the villain is, how great or terrible Bond is, and how much, like, the person who's singing Mrs. Bond as a lover or as a person. And that brassy female voice works for so many of them that it almost seems like it is an inextricable part of the Bond saga, that there's this person in his wake, and this is kind of one of those songs where someone is almost singing his eulogy throughout. And I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah, and I think it goes without saying that they definitely have a type, because if you look at who's sung all the Bond songs, the vast majority are women.
Totally, 100%. So I guess, John, you tell us your number four, because I just already went, and then Daniel, yeah. Then we can go to you, and then we can keep changing the order a little bit, right?
I think you'll like this. Nobody Does It Better, The Spy Who Loved Me by Carly Simon.
You're wrong. It's better than that.
Sorry.
Well, I prefer the upbeat big band version that they had at the end of
it. Oh, no.
Nobody Does It Better. That was my personal.
You're dead
preference.
To me. You're off this podcast now. Nope. Goodbye. You are the weakest link. Yeah, it's a. I mean, I like Carly Simon in general. She's definitely a product of her era, and for a movie that really wasn't all that great, it was a fantastic song. It was very disco, but subtle disco, and it's just gorgeous. It's a gorgeous song. And if I remember right, when we were watching the movie way back when, we were all humming it. We were singing it when the thing was happening. And I'm pretty sure we hadn't seen it in years. So it's, I think it's just one of those classics.
Well, one of the things that got me about that particular song was it sounds like it's one of the few songs where it just doesn't sound like a standalone thing to introduce the title. It sounds like somebody actually speaking or singing to Bond as a character.
Which is a very unique thing to do. And I think it worked well with the movie because she's playing the role of the spy, I guess. And
oh, the Barbara Bach role then?
Yeah. And it just works. And it's just gorgeous.
I'm Ringo Starr, and that's me wife.
And if I remember right, it even placed on the charts. Not number one, but it was decently received.
Oh, yeah. No, it was a huge hit back in the day.
So do you want me to get into this now, or do you want me to wait till it comes up as on my list?
You can go into it now. Go for it.
So I picked this as my favorite song, and there's a lot of reasons for it. First of all, I think, like you said, I think it's charming 100% on its own. I think it's a good song on its own. But second of all, it's one of the few that I think, A, give the women any sort of say, right? Because, you know, she's singing about being heartbroken and things like that. She's not fawning over him. But I think it's just, it's a beautiful song. I agree with you. I agree, frankly, with everything you say. I just think that pushed it to the top for me. Because I think it's, God, it's a phenomenal song. And we'll get into what I think a lot of you put higher than I did. But the reason why I think it's better than anything else is that I loved this song before I realized it was a Bond theme. And the fact that it's a Bond theme doesn't improve it, but it also doesn't hurt it. I think it is perfectly appropriate as a love theme about, you know, the Barbara Bach part, like you said. But also, it is what it is. I think the movie is good. I think the song is good, and neither take away from each other, which is hard to do in some of these. So I think it's just a spectacular piece.
The movie is really still one of my favorite Roger Moore Bond outings.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, Daniel, that was on your list too. It was number two, right?
It was. It was. For the reasons that Nick's talking about, I almost made it number one, like Nick, but I won't. There was one that edged it out ever so slightly, but I'll save that for later.
Oh, we're going to have some words over that, but don't you worry. We'll
I know what
there.
It is, I bet, and I'm going to argue with you on it.
Well, I'm ready and prepared.
Let's work our way up.
Comparing one and two is not, like, that different. So,
yeah.
Dana, why don't you give us your number four?
All right. I'm going to go ahead and spoil one element that's on my list. I excluded Goldfinger because I imagined everybody was going to include that anyway. So it meant that ultimately there are no Sean Connery picks on my personal list. The reason for that was I actually went back and looked up all the Sean Connery picks, and the thing about them is they still sound kind of like they weren't ready to really embrace what was happening at the time. Like, they were all kind of lounge music-y. They were, a lot of them were instrumental. There weren't, like, any pop stars at the time that were really working on anything. And that kind of worked because Bond in, I think it was Goldfinger, was disparaging the Beatles, for example. So my number four pick was the moment where they dropped that trend and actually decided to take a look at, oh, what's going on in the world around us and how can we make Bond respond to that rather than acting like he's above it. So I chose Paul McCartney's Live and Let Die.
When you were young and your heart.
Here's the problem with that song.
Open book.
You rated it too low.
I
think he rated it too high.
Really?
I'm not a big fan of that song.
Interesting. I will say, your argument is going to be probably the reason why I didn't make number one for me.
Oh, because it was too poppy and too dated?
No. I mean, it's upbeat, which there are a few of them. I didn't like the Linda McCartney reggae section in the middle.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, it's number two for me. So it's not like I hated the song. I love the song. I think it's an excellent song. It doesn't feel like it's a Bond song, which is something we'll get into later when we talk about, I assume, things like our least favorite. But
at the same time, it's definitely, I think of all the Bond songs, it's the only one that's still played on the radio routinely.
Well, it was also covered a lot. I know Guns N' Roses did a cover of it at one point, and that gets played on the radio a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And Carly Simon's is played now and again, but, you know, since it's a downbeat classic rock song, they don't play it as often. Live and Let Die is not only poppy, but very upbeat in that way that almost all Wings songs are, although I think it's technically just Paul McCartney before he formed Wings.
I think you're right.
I think it might be a Wings song, but I just remember when Paul McCartney did it at the Super Bowl back in 2005.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's probably part of the reason it's still played more often than not, because A, it's Paul McCartney, and I'm sure he has some sort of rights to it, because as Paul McCartney, he can probably demand that.
Yeah, probably. No, it probably cost the Broccoli's a lot of money to get Paul McCartney to do it.
He's a good choice for the first outing as Roger Moore, because I'm sure they were nervous as to how he would be received, given how the last transition happened. So they needed to knock the song out of the park.
Well, they needed to knock everything out of the park, and with Live and Let Die, they, at least from what I remember, they really didn't, because it wasn't that good. But anyway,
It was very cringeworthy.
I still love the song because it was them actually, for once, they were trying to get on board with the trends and even break the trends rather than just completely ignoring them.
Agreed.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. So, Daniel, keep going. What's your number three?
My number three, okay, I referenced it earlier, and for whatever reason, I really like the transition Bond themes, like when it goes from one Bond to the next. And my number three is kind of a response to that. It's back to a deeper, more classical singer for a Bond theme, but at the same time, they did a more contemporary writers to do it. And in this case, they hired Bono and the Edge to write the song and had Tina Turner sing it. It's Goldeneye. And I like it because not only because of the sound, but because the lyrics kind of respond to Bond. If you listen to them, at least when I was listening to them, it almost sounds like the KGB equivalent of Bond singing about how he's so frustrated that he is always in Bond's shadow.
Yeah, it's a solid song, and it's definitely up there for a lot of people, and for a generation, definitely. It was their first outing mm-hmm. in James Bond, and obviously you have the video game, which didn't quite pick up that song, but Goldeneye in general holds a special place in a lot of people's hearts.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and it's interesting because it did a lot of the things we talked about with Adele, where they got a woman with a brassy voice to sing in not as aggressive of a song, but, you know, something like it. It's akin to what we were talking about elsewhere. I think the reason why this theme in general is forgotten comparatively is how bad a lot of the rest of the score is. Because, I mean, we did this movie, we all like this movie, but it's all techno-y, and, like, when he's driving around the tank, it's almost EDM music. And so this is something that throws back to old Bond, but the rest of the music has none of the John Barry charm to it.
Which is interesting, because the composer for the music for GoldenEye has come back time and again. I don't recall his name offhand, but I know that he's done basically just about every movie, I think, since then. David Arnold, I think that's his name.
Correct.
Yeah, I was about to say Tom Arnold, and I'm like, that is a completely different guy.
Completely different. I'm sure the music would be similar, but this one's better. I remember hearing that they tried to do something different for GoldenEye with David Arnold.
Well, they wanted to get the Rolling Stones originally, but the Rolling Stones said no.
I'm surprised they didn't do U2.
Did they think they would have retired by the time the movie came out? Because that would have been funny.
I don't know.
That would have been funky. I can't even think of what that would have been like. Can you imagine the Rolling Stones doing this song?
Oh, man, that would have been so funny.
Move. They're smoking mirrors. That's all I got right there.
Yeah, just like that. Yeah.
Oh, man. But to have someone cock strutting around saying, oh, I'm invincible! I am invincible!
Well, that's what Mick Jagger does every day when he looks at himself in the mirror and reminds himself he's still alive.
That's why it's so natural when he says it.
Yeah. Yeah. It. God, that would have been a mess of a song.
Yeah,
sure. It probably would have been elsewhere on my personal list.
Okay, so Daniel.
Yes?
We're talking about the difference between kind of gloomy and upbeat. What if they made a hybrid like Smashing Pumpkins? Would that have made it unlistenable?
Well, they kind of did later, and we'll get into that.
Well played, sir.
Ooh.
Segue.
Ooh. All right, Nick, what's your number three?
Goldfinger! There's an episode of Raiders, stay with me, where the dad, the war vet, is trying to prove that his sons can be cool and have fun, as you do. And they go to a karaoke bar, and the sons don't know anything, any of the songs, because of course they don't, because Niles is a prat, and Frasier's a dipshit. He's kind of an asshole. But that's his character, he's an asshole. They argue about cheese half the episodes. But there's one song that all three of them know, and that's Goldfinger. Why? Not only, like Daniel said, everyone's going to choose it because it's ubiquitous, and it's charming, but it effectively revives, I want to say it's going to revive the genre. The lounge era, I mean, being 50 years away from it, we forget this. But the thing is, they were all irrelevant. Like, the joke that Sean Connery makes that Daniel alluded to earlier, the only way to listen to the Beatles is with earmuffs, which is made in the episode we're talking about, in the movie we're talking about. It's because Bond is of a bygone era. Goldfinger is of a bygone era, and yet it is so utterly charming that they rip off the song almost verbatim 4 or 5 times, and they're still trying to re-grasp it. It's what makes this movie, at least one of the things that makes this movie, the quintessential Bond movie. Even if it's not the best of any particular part of what makes a Bond movie, it makes it so quintessential that I find it utterly charming.
Well, the amazing thing about it as well is how it permeated through 1960s pop culture. Like, I seem to remember reading about how they used that song in cigarette commercials, and then in Wolf of Wall Street, there's a scene where it may even be Shirley Bassey is singing it at somebody's wedding. So it's just amazing, and it might have been the first real breakaway song from a Bond film.
I think it's the song that put Bond on the map, really.
Yeah.
That it is, as you say, we're still talking about it 50 years later. And it's quintessential in a lot of ways. And it's just a good song, definitely.
Beck wants you to enter his web of sin.
But don't look in. but I was going to say on top of that, is it feels so inextricable from the movie, which a lot of these Bond songs that we're going to get into, even the ones that we liked, just don't. Like, I mean, for example, Honor Majesty's Secret Service, which I don't know if any of us chose, but let's just pretend that no one did.
I did too,
because it's a wonderfully charming orchestral song. And I think it's well done. And we said no, Doctor No, because it's just the Bond theme, of course. But those make the Bond movie feel like a Bond movie. The theme hits. But Goldfinger is a song that someone's singing about how great the villain is. And yet, the villain is destined to lose. So it's kind of like, it's almost like the front man. It's the Flava Flav of the movie. Like, it's supposed to tell you, don't worry about it. He's the worst that can be. Even though he's a pudgy, fat Irish or Scottish guy. Like,
technically German.
Please. Let's not associate him with the British Isles, right?
Right, yeah. But, I mean, it looking at Goldfinger, and to the point you just made, that it's in some ways disassociated from the movie itself, it's definitely a problem a lot of the songs had. And I'm looking at you, GoldenEye, that it's almost like the lyrics were made in a complete vacuum from the movie. And so GoldenEye, the song, is all about a man called GoldenEye.
Well, yeah. I'm gonna pull a Lumberg and kind of disagree with you there.
Yeah.
I mean, again, I'm a... First and foremost, GoldenEye was about a spy satellite, and technically the song lyrics of the GoldenEye are personifying that, as well as the 00 agent that Sean Bean portrayed. Second, I mean, with Goldfinger, I don't know if it was really as connected to the movie beyond the villain's name, really.
Like I said, a lot of the early songs, and really a lot of the songs in general, have little to nothing to do with the movie itself.
Right, exactly.
Certainly the visuals from the movies generally had nothing to do with especially for the earlier movies.
Well, and I think this song is on a lot of people's list because Bond as a package is an interesting idea, because Sean Connery especially is charming as fuck. I mean... And, you know, he's a good-looking strong man for the era, which means that I could be Sean Connery strong in a way. You know, like, no one should ever be Daniel Craig strong. He's right. The best-looking guy. But, he had a guy on set. I imagine Sean Connery just made sure he ate enough meat and whiskey so that he kept his current form.
If you told me that the guy who played Stamper in Tomorrow Never Dies was actually Daniel Craig, I would probably have believed you. they're very similar in body type.
You mean Vincent Schiavelli? No. Stamper was that angry German dude that
The one devoid of character, that guy.
Yes, that guy. The one who wanted so bad to be what's his name from With Russia with Love. Here's the thing. Sean Connery is, to me, in some ways, the most believable Bond, but he's also Bond in the package. This is Sean Connery wearing this blue terry cloth, right? This is him fighting Auric Goldfinger, who's just a fat guy in a gold terry cloth. And this is atomic bombs and Cold War. And, like, this is, like, the Cold War in a nutshell. And a brassy black woman jazz singer is the one who's carrying us home. I'm totally charmed by the whole notion. It makes it a period piece, but some ways, not unlike Archer, I think Bond belongs in the 60s.
I don't disagree. And this is the quintessential 60s type song. It's very Sinatra. It's very Las Vegas, really, which I'm sure we'll keep coming back to.
Agreed. Yeah. So who's next for number three?
That's me. My number three is Tomorrow Never Dies. Before you say anything, let me defend myself here.
All right,
so Tomorrow Never Dies as a whole has grown on me. That when I first saw it, I had high expectations that it would be another GoldenEye. It was not. But it's got a charm to it that I can't quite place. And part of that comes from the theme song.
I'm sorry to interrupt, John. I love Jonathan Pryce in Tomorrow Never Dies. He is just so wonderfully over the top that he makes the movie. And you're right, it's very charming.
Yeah.
It was great having Rupert Murdoch as a Camp Bond villain.
And it fit with the time period, and arguably we could have it again, and no one would bat an eye. But it was moving on to a fear of globalization, I guess, which at that time was picking up. And the movie itself is still pretty relevant, albeit it's a little campy right now. But I thought Sheryl Crow was an interesting departure from GoldenEye with Tina Turner, which, as we just discussed, was a throwback to the Shirley Bassey. Sheryl Crow doing Tomorrow Never Dies was more of the rock thing that they were going for that they followed up with in Garbage in the next film. And she hit the right notes. She was kind of a brassy female voice, and she's got good lyrics. It had, for the time, good special effects in the video. And it was just kind of a fun song. I won't call it a great song, but it was a fun song.
This is where I'm going to surrender myself. The only reason I didn't consider this is because I can't stand Sheryl Crow, and never really have been able to. I think, what was that song she did in the early 90s? That one, like, All I Wanna Do Is Have Some Fun. That's one of the laziest songs I've ever heard.
That's why it hit the charts.
See, I'm going to argue with Daniel just a little bit. First of all, I get it, because I've listened, first of all, I said first of all six times, so I'm going to say first of all one more time.
Second of all.
I think, yeah, Jagged Little Pill, I think, is a phenomenal album. I think the only reason why I didn't put this, and it was high on my list, because I think it did everything that we talked about, right?
Are you talking about Alanis Morissette?
Yeah, she's that's one, Jagged Little Pill.
Oh, you're right, I hated this song now. No, I'm kidding. I was going to say, I like this song. God, what was Sheryl Crow's album?
Tuesday Night Music Club, I think.
I think you're right. I like the album. I like the song. I like her. I think the only reason why I didn't put this higher was it sounds too much like it wasn't her song, if that makes sense. I think she wasn't able to make it her own as much. I think she was a good choice. Oh my God, it's going to take me a second. Phil, one of you, Phil, because someone wrote an alternative song to this.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me that they tend to put the songs out for bid almost, don't they? That they get a short list of musicians. And
you know, the movie came out in 1997. I'm surprised they didn't try and get Celine Dion involved.
I'm sure they tried.
Another lady, though, Katie Lang wrote a song.
Ew. Really?
And it was over the end credits.
Oh, yeah, that was GoldenEye. Yeah, that was GoldenEye.
It was on Tomorrow Never Dies. It's over the end credits. It's called Surrender. And she was the one originally hired, but I believe it was Wilson didn't like it, or one of the Broccolis. Maybe it was Barbara Broccoli didn't like it. So they put it at the end and then hired Sheryl Crow.
You know who should have done it instead? Because he was still around back then doing music? Will Smith.
Right.
I thought you were going to say the fat guy from Blues Traveler. John Popper, obscure 90s reference.
Blues Traveler wouldn't be an they would be an interesting choice. I wouldn't call them a good choice, but they'd be an interesting choice.
What about a ska band like Gold?
No Doubt.
You mean like No Doubt?
I'm done.
Brian Setzer.
Oh my God, that'd be great.
You need Squirrel Nut Zippers.
Oh, there you go.
Sorry, Poppin' Daddies.
Yeah, yeah. There was a surprising amount of ska back in the day, wasn't there?
There was.
Someone should have done one. I mean, we're not to this point yet, but Ray Charles.
Huh.
Well, they can just hire Jamie Foxx to do it now.
Not like he's doing much else, is he?
Yeah.
I guess we're to the top six.
Yeah. Daniel, you go.
What are we on? Number two?
Number two.
Number two.
All right. Number two is one that has already been discussed. Nobody Does It Better.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
That's high on your list. Why was it so high?
For me?
Yeah.
I am struggled whether to put this at number one or number two, and it ended up at number two. I guess it's so high. First,
you should have put it as number one. I can see what you put as number one, and I disagree with you, but we'll get there.
We'll get to that. There's two reasons, I think. First, there's a personal connection. The first Bond film that I ever had was a VHS copy of The World Is Not Enough. And one of the things they had on that VHS was this tribute to Desmond Llewellyn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he had just died, and it was all of the best clips with him, and that was the song that they played under it. So every time we'd watch that movie, we'd always sit back and watch the final, the best Q moments, and listen to that song. So part of it's personal. The other part is just, I think, what Nick said. It's like so well written, and it just sets the perfect mood for a Bond movie, especially one that's kind of 180 from what Roger Moore usually did back in the day, where instead of being campy, he was actually trying to be serious. So, plus, I don't know. It's really just hard to explain why I like it so much. I guess just because every time I listen to it, it just affects me the same way that it always does.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a solid song, and it's on all five of us, all three of us top five. So, I mean, it's a strong contender for best overall, really.
No.
Yeah. Nick, what was your number two?
Live and Let Die. I mean, frankly, for the reasons we've already talked about as well, I like Sir Paul, and this is, whether it's Wings or just him or whatever, there's elements of, you know, Linda, and there's elements of the Beatles, but I appreciate it because it matches the tone of the movie. You know, and that's something we haven't talked about all that much. It's not only a fun song, like I think Daniel said, it's on the charts all the time, and people still play it on classic radio, and if it came up, no one would complain. But it's also that when Roger Moore steps onto the stage, he's a different kind of Bond. He's a little bit humorous. He's lighthearted. This song is charming across the way, and if the movie is going to have voodoo in it and the henchman is going to survive till the end and appear on the front of a freaking train, you know, like, you need a whimsical song, and this song just slots right into a perfect little wheelhouse, doesn't it? It's just, it's so good in a way that, you know, it belongs pretty much on any list of movie songs ever. And considering how this franchise has found a way to make it so you don't actually need to have the song play throughout, George Martin then produced the score, so this theme plays throughout. It's amazing, and I just find it utterly charming because of that. The only thing that made it second overall is that weird Linda McCartney reggae section, which makes it feel so forced, when it should have just been charming across the way. Had that been taken out, I think it would have been a near-perfect song.
Yeah, I don't disagree, yeah.
I didn't know George Martin produced the score to that.
Yeah, he actually replaced some of their standard cast of characters, and he gets a musical credit here, because I guess after the Beatles broke up, he knew who to put his investment into.
Well, it could very well that Paul McCartney and George Martin came as a package.
I mean, but again, he also could have been following John Lennon or the Traveling Wilburys, but I think he made the right choice by following Paul. So,
yeah, I don't disagree. This is basically if the Beatles did a James Bond movie.
Yeah, pretty much. It's A Hard Day's Night, but with Roger Moore. So.
Interesting. Let's not think about that too hard. So my
better movie or the best? Okay, so I'm going to divert a second for a minute. In the 60s, the Beatles tried to make a Lord of the Rings movie.
Ooh.
They were actually fighting for the rights, and then they lost them last minute. But, like, can you imagine them doing, like, a Led Zeppelin style? Like, oh, get the ring, Frodo. Like, kind of like, oh, my God. That might have been the greatest thing ever.
Is this when they tried to hire Stanley Kubrick to direct it?
They did indeed, yeah.
Wow. I can't decide whether that would have been good or bad.
There's an alternate universe where all of us are mesmerized with it in the same way that people who sync up Pink Floyd to
Wizard of Oz.
Wizard of Oz.
Thank you. That's the alternative, right? It's that kind of bullshit.
I did that once back in college. It doesn't work.
It works a little bit. Right. Yeah, we've all done that. Yeah. It works for about 5 minutes, and then you have to move on.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So, speaking of moving on, my number two is one we haven't discussed yet. Diamonds Are Forever by Shirley Bassey. Yeah.
Yeah.
As a whole, I enjoy the movie, and it's definitely a transition from the 60s to the 70s. It's 1971, so there you go. But it was Sean Connery's last proper outing. And similar to Live and Let Die, whoever did the score on this one, I have no idea who it was, the theme was repeated throughout the movie. And so it's kind of a almost a crystal type theme, a repeated motif that is worked into the entire soundtrack of the movie, and it begins with this song. And Shirley Bassey, we've discussed, is already a pretty phenomenal singer, and this is just really good. I like it.
It's an interesting choice, I think, and I agree. I like Diamonds Are Forever, because it's kind of like someone who likes the Smith versus someone who likes Morrissey. I think Goldfinger is the original, and then Diamonds Are Forever is the much more polished version. I have no complaints over it. You know, the hipster in me wants to like the original more, but
damn you,
that doesn't mean it's a better song. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously she had a type, or she was a type, that all her songs kind of mixed together. Like, I was listening to this the other day, and Moonraker, also by Shirley Bassey, is a pretty solid song. It is good in a way that the movie is not, but it's very similar to her other theme songs.
Yeah.
Daniel, are you still there?
I'm still here. I honestly don't remember too much about Diamonds Are Forever.
Diamonds Are Forever, forever, forever.
I've heard it, but it's like whenever a Bond theme list comes up, that's always like one of the ones where I go, oh yeah, that one was nice, and then just sort of move on to the ones that I prefer. So I don't know.
Yeah, it's just an interesting song. I don't know, I just like it. It's fun. It's classy and it's sparkly.
I do like sparkly as an adjective for anything Cassie does, so well done.
Yeah, so Nick, we've already covered your number one. You did Nobody Does It Better.
Yeah, and we did it pretty well because nobody did it better than how I described it. But listen to Carly Simon, man. I think it's an utterly charming and perfect song.
Yeah, Daniel, we're going to have some fun with this. Your number one is?
Why don't we do your number one first?
Okay, all right. My number one is, it really shouldn't come as too much of a surprise, but From Russia With Love.
From Russia
With Love.
Like, I mean, technically it wasn't actually aired in the film. It's by, what's his name, Monroe? Tom Monroe?
Yeah.
Matt Monroe. And it's along similar lines as the Shirley Bassey. It's very lounge singery. And there was an instrumental, which was the main theme of the movie, and they had another version that was at the end of the film, but the version that I guess is on all the soundtrack lists has Matt Monroe singing it, and it's just a classy kind of song, and it's when they were still trying to figure out who James Bond was, and it's like a proto Shirley Bassey. It's in a similar vein. You can hear this kind of someone doing it in a lounge somewhere, and it's a guy, so he's got a good, not baritone, but he's got a good voice going for him, and it's just classy. I like it, and I love the film overall, but this just sealed the deal for me.
Yeah.
What?
Go ahead, Danny.
I was just saying, that's not a bad pick. It really does set that 60s aesthetic that Sean Connery was known for.
Here's the thing. It's in the middle of the pack for me, which still makes it a good song. There are few bad songs on this list. The reason why I don't like it too much compared to some of the others we've picked and why you're wrong is because it's very over the top. It's a lot of big flourishes, which is fine. It's just, of all the movies, From Russia with Love is the most like a Le Carré piece. And this song just feels completely whimsical. Like, it's so filled with... I don't know. You're right. It is the most 1960s, possibly, of all the songs, even more so in some ways than Goldfinger, because Goldfinger has transcended. It's just in such a big shadow. You're right. It's a proto-song for what's to come, which doesn't necessarily make it bad. That's why it's frustrating to me. But it's followed by Shirley Bassey in Goldfinger, and then followed by Thunderball, which is, Tom Jones, yeah. Who's essentially doing Shirley Bassey. So, I don't know. It's just a weird one. I'm glad you chose it, because I think it'll make a lot of people look into it, which they should, because Matt Monro is otherwise a forgotten speed bump in musical history.
Oh, definitely. And I love the fact that you can hear the Shirley Bassey in it. You can hear the Tom Jones in it. That it's of the era, it's of the style, and you could almost argue that Shirley Bassey and Tom Jones cribbed off him, that yeah. He was the first proper Bond theme song, and I just love that.
I'm not arguing with you. I know, and he definitely had a goal, or whoever wrote it had a goal, right?
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just like it. It's a fun, classy kind of song. Like I could easily see this transposed in like a Pink Panther kind of movie. That it's yeah. The same type that Henry Mancini would have picked.
Totally.
Yeah, I can see that now that you bring up Henry Mancini.
Yeah, because I was watching A Shot in the Dark the other day, and that opening song could easily have been something like this. But anyway.
And what's your number one? You were afraid to bring it up, so I'm curious.
Oh, I'm not afraid to bring it up. I just know it's going to create a conversation. All right. I'm going to set the stage for this before I actually give it, because
that's how you
I think
know he's afraid
it
to do
really
it.
Works in context.
Ah.
When the film was released, Bond had been stagnant. He was considered a has-been character who really was almost a critical joke at the time. So when they made this movie, they rebuilt him, essentially. They rebuilt him in a way that brought him into a lot of modern film techniques, but still kept the classic Bond image with him. And it's gone on to be, the Bond has gone on to be probably the most acclaimed run of Bond films ever. And this was also, as I said on the podcast, my favorite Bond film when we reviewed it. So it's going to be my favorite Bond song as well, I guess. And that's the late, great Chris Cornell's You Know My Name from Casino Royale. Now, the reason that I think it works is because, first, it doesn't really sound like any of the other Bond songs up until that point. Like you guys were saying, a lot of them were based more on jazz or on female vocalists and that sort of thing. And Chris Cornell is obviously neither of those things. Plus, it's a lot heavier than a lot of the classic Bond songs as well. Like you're saying, From Russia with Love, it would kind of make sense to play it at a swinging 60s cocktail party. This one doesn't fit that at all, but at the same time, it does include some classic Bond motifs. Plus, I think it's the only Bond song that's written from Bond's point of view.
So it's
a great way to reintroduce that character in the same way that the film did.
I don't disagree. I just don't like the song. I mean, it introduced us to the more hard rocky kind of thing that we got with this, and then Jack White following it up.
Can you really blame Chris Cornell for Jack White? I mean, yeah, that's...
We can blame so many other people for Jack White. But, he opened the door to it. It was definitely unconventional, which is fine. I'm okay with unconventional. And it's not a bad song. Don't get me wrong. And very few of the Bond songs are bad songs. It just wouldn't be anywhere near my number one.
That's fair. I understand that. And as a standalone song, it really is... I don't know if it's aged all that well. I mean, I remember it sounding very good when it came out, but I don't know if it's something that I would continuously play on a car trip without the context that it was a Bond song. But in context with the movie, I think it works really well. It fits the visuals of that opening theme. The lyrics are great in setting up the Bond character again and what to expect from him. I don't know. It really worked for me.
I like it because of the hook. I mean, you know, it's got the good rough da-na, 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 which is essentially the Bond theme played rocked out. But then inside of it, it has some minor themes which get played throughout the score. And it's interesting because, follow me on this, it follows the wave of sound mentality that a lot of, you know, 70s and 80s music does. But it's only a handful of instruments, and as opposed to some Shirley Bassey stuff or whatever, or the Nancy Sinatra song even, which has essentially like a jazz orchestra behind them, it's actually a fairly thin song for a very thin movie. I like the movie. But Bond doesn't have a lot of gadgets. Bond doesn't have a lot of tools. He's on his own. So it's a very thin Bond, which makes it, I think, more of a spy movie. I think it fits nicely, but, I mean, not unlike John, I think it's in the middle of my pack. It's an interesting choice, especially now that Chris Cornell has passed, but I'm not opposed to you choosing it. It surprises me that you think it belongs at the top, and I'm, in a way, not that I disagree with you, because obviously you're a man of your word, but I wonder where you'll put it in 5 years.
Well, it's already been 10 years, hasn't it, since the movie came out?
Yeah. Well, right, but he also died 6 months ago, so I've listened to this song much more in the last 6 months, in the last 6 weeks than I have in the previous 10 years.
Yeah. And to me, of that movie, Casino Royale, this was the least memorable part of it. And I just wasn't a big fan of it. I mean, Chris Cornell is
a fan of that wonderful opening sequence that was like, that pretty much created the Mad Men theme sequence and the wonderful.
Oh, the visuals are fantastic. The visuals are amazing. I just don't like the song. I know that's splitting hairs, but yeah.
No, it's not. I mean, Sheena Easton's boobs you can see, so that's okay for that theme, but that doesn't mean it's a good theme. Now, some people like the Four Eyes Only theme, but whatever. I mean, we're splitting hairs. I think everything above the
absolutely.
Top 20 we all enjoyed, so...
Oh, yeah. And I think that does bear to be said that, as I said, there aren't many songs that are just atrocious. We've all got our top. And like Daniel said, Goldfinger is up there. It's not on my top five, but it's probably number six.
The reason I didn't include Goldfinger in my top five again was because I knew everybody was going to pick that, or at least one person was, and I wanted to try and be original.
And really, I was like you. I consciously decided, do I want to pick that? I want to shake things up a little bit. And I'm glad I did. But yeah, it's easily one of the top songs out there.
Well, and I mean, like we said, nobody does it better. So what's next, John, now that we've talked about another one?
Well, let's talk about just quickly some of the worst ones. Daniel, you have a fun worst one. Go for it.
Okay, I'm not even going to give a teaser. The worst one is Madonna's Die Another Day.
Really?
Oh, by far. Well... to be fair, and I'll try to be fair, when I was going into this, it was a toss-up between that and Lulu's The Man with a Golden Gun.
Ah!
Yeah.
But, man, just on its own, that song is just so abrasive and lyrically bad, and musically it's just all over the place. And is she even singing on that track?
Well, she has audio clips. I wouldn't call it singing.
It sounds like she recorded her voice onto a Casio keyboard and they just sampled that and would occasionally, like, pull a Gene Belcher and press a button and then a screech would be heard and that was the song. Plus, I mean...
Daniel. It was avant-garde, okay? She was trying to send a message.
Sigmund Freud analyzed this indeed.
Exactly.
Well, I don't even know how that song ties into the movie, though. I mean... I guess it's about Bond coming back from the torture in North Korea that he faced, but it's a real stretch to tie that into the character at all.
Well, I mean, here's what I'm going to say. As we're recording this, in 1963, the episode of The Twilight Zone where where there was something out on the wing and it's a gremlin, that has as much to do with this episode as the song does to Die Another Day. I'm helping.
And to be fair, that whole movie was a train wreck.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be the pinnacle of James Bond, and it ended up being one of the worst things ever filmed.
it was a clip show, is what it was. It was like a Bond clip show. It didn't really even have a script. They just like, oh, hey, here's a shot of this hallway. Do you remember when we had a similar shot back in Thunderball?
Right. Skyfall did a much better job of doing throwbacks because they weren't really focused on as much. And right. yet, Die Another Day, almost every single scene had a throwback in it to the point where it was obvious. Almost to the point yeah. where it's like Tomorrow Never Dies with their product placement.
I don't disagree. It's frustrating to me because I like Pierce Brosnan, but as Bond, by the end, he was just a joke. And, like, he seemed to know it. His accent would cut in and out. It was bad. And this song, especially, is techno-y. It's disgusting. It's my bottom, too, so I'm going to talk a little bit about it now. But it just... It's gross in a way that it not only doesn't feel like it belongs in the Bond universe, but it feels like it doesn't belong in any universe. It's gross. It's really disgusting. And it just feels so rough.
It much like the rest of the movie, and this is definitely among my least favorite. But at the same time, for maybe a minute, I thought about putting this on my favorites. And I'll explain why. That I have an affinity to orchestral soundtracks with some techno added in. And there are definitely ways, examples of this being done well. Die Another Day is not necessarily an example of doing it well. But I like the style.
Well, I think what would have made it even worse for me was the fact that Madonna showed up in the movie. And it's like, you have not even come close to earning that.
Oh, God, yes. She could have done something like from the 80s Madonna, and that would have been more appealing than this song.
You know what would have been interesting, even though she wouldn't have done it because she was insane at that point? Lauryn Hill doing a Bond theme at that time.
Really?
Well,
really just
Sinead
anybody.
Madonna could have worked, too. Any crazy person. You could have gotten Metallica, and it would have been better.
Ooh, Britney Spears.
Well, Metallica had already done Mission Impossible, so they'd already picked their spy franchise.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at the same time, who can forget the classic Bond theme by Weird Al?
Yeah, I almost put that as my guilty pleasure.
for those who don't know, it is the theme of Spy Hard, starring Leslie Nielsen.
Which movie is mostly unwatchably bad, but... Weird Al is so good, and there's so many jokes in there that, like, was it Nancy Sinatra who held her voice the note so long she fainted? And, like, anyway, they even do a video at the beginning. It's really worth a watch if you haven't seen it.
Oh, definitely.
You should post this on the page with the episode.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, because it's funny. It makes fun of Bond, and it's a much better song than Die Another Day. Worst song, actually... I blame Chris Cornell for it. It was Another Way to Die by Jack White and Alicia Keys for Quantum of Solace. To me, this was an offensive song. It was one step away from a rap song. It was... There really wasn't anything redemptive about this. It was just... It was stupid.
See, I don't disagree with you in that it's a bad song, but I'm wondering why you blame Chris Cornell for that.
Well, he started this, damn it. You Know My Name opened the way for kind of a rocky, unconventional style. And given the success of that song, which I'm not disagreeing with, that it's a decent song, that Jack White and Alicia Keys? Really?
Yeah, it's Alicia Keys.
No, this was not a good song. And for a movie that's basically as depressing as Quantum of Solace was, I would have been okay with more of a subdued song. And this was... I don't see how this really fit in at all.
I mean, I don't disagree with you that that's a bad song. I just think it's unfair to blame that on Chris Cornell. I mean, it's purely Jack White's fault.
Oh, I don't disagree.
Bizarre.
Yeah.
Oh, I get it. He's just saying that Chris Cornell's was popular, so they went on to someone like Jack White. That doesn't make it Jack White. But anyway.
Yeah. Guilty pleasure? Yeah?
I'll jump right off here. Mine is the White Stripes song. I'll tell you why. It's a terrible Bond song. It's one of the worst Bond songs. It's really weird. But I love Jack White. I love the White Stripes. I like his independent stuff, and I love the Recon Tours. And to me, this sounds like a Jack White song. That being said, I don't think it belongs anywhere near a Bond movie. I think it's inappropriate. I think it's poppy in the way that Jack White is poppy, which is an alternative kind of almost hard rock thing, which is everything Bond should never, ever, ever, ever be. But that being said, if it was just on the back of a Jack White album, I'd find this song just as charming because it sounds like Jack White. Now, I like Jack White. If you don't like Jack White, you're going to hate it, and it definitely doesn't deserve to be near a Bond movie. But I kind of like this song as a Jack White song.
I'm a lady now. Exactly. Exactly.
That's pretty good cover right there.
Stealing
all the water, I'll make him drink the oil.
And that's why Daniel and I are starting an improv troupe called Kinda Sad and Sad White Guys Doing Improv.
Oh, we totally need to do that now. You know that,
right? Yeah.
White and Dumpy. Something like that. Yeah, we'll figure it out, Daniel. Yeah.
Yourself, sir.
Yeah.
I am. What's yours, Danny?
All right. Now, again, I think I'm going to put a bit of context with this. First, I consider this a guilty pleasure because, again, I don't think that it really is appropriate for a Bond song because of what you were talking about earlier, Nick, about it being really too morose and too 90s grungy sounding. But when I, again, that same VHS tape that I had with the Q tribute on it had the original music video for this, and every time I was watching it, my parents would make me fast forward through the music video of this song because it would creep them out. So I'm just like going, ooh, it's kind of forbidden.
It would creep them out?
Yeah.
Huh, okay.
That's what he said. But anyway, also, I just really like the band. Their debut self-titled album is one of my favorites. Plus, I got to meet them over the summer, got their autobiography signed, and shook Butch Vig's hand, which probably just gave away what the song is. It's The World Is Not Enough by Garbage.
Now, see, I wouldn't call this a guilty pleasure, because actually I enjoy this song. And like you, I'm a fan of Garbage. And the movie was okay, but the song is similar to what we said with
as a garbage B side rather than a Bond song.
Exactly, like I was just going to say that similar to Nick's point that Jack White's song didn't deserve to be anywhere near a Bond movie. This song arguably didn't deserve to be near a Bond movie either, but it was still a decent song, I thought.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're very good at what they do. I mean, Butch Vig was already an excellent producer before he even got that band together.
Garbage was like a super group for producers, basically.
Yeah.
Well, to be fair, this movie didn't deserve to be a Bond movie either, so...
Yeah.
It's a guilty pleasure in my heart because it's the first one that I consistently saw... I remember we rented Tomorrow Never Dies when I was a kid, but I wasn't allowed to see it because I was being grounded that night for something.
Aww.
I forget what. So I think that was really the first one I actually saw. So
yeah, but this one should have hit all the right notes. It was the same style as Tomorrow Never Dies. It was more of their pop rock kind of vibe, and it had a brassy female lead. And
see, that's what gets it with me, though, is I'm not sure if Shirley Manson really had the right sort of jazzy voice. I mean, Shirley Manson's a great singer, but it's a different style than, like, the pop Bond sound that even Shirley Bassey or Adele has.
I don't disagree. It's a different style, but yeah, it's an okay song.
Yeah, man. I don't know. I'm not opposed to this song. Again, it's near the middle of mine, but it has an interesting hook. So I'm not You know, I like a song that feels different-y, but again, I don't know, it's just, it's right near the top of my edge, so I think it's number 12 or 13 on my list. I think it's interesting. It's just everything around that brought it down, you know what I mean? I know it's one of your first Bond movies, and I believe it's the first one I went to the theater by myself to see. I'm a little older than you, mm-hmm. but, like, it's a forgettable movie, and so I think that buries the song. Goldfinger, I think we've all heard 1,000 times, even if it's not our favorite, because Goldfinger was on TBS all the time.
Right.
You know, like, and of the movies, Pierce Brosnan's, other than Goldeneye, tend to get buried. So I think this one just wasn't it. They just really tried to make the Madonna song a hit, and it was a swing and a miss, but that doesn't mean they didn't try. So, you know, this one's an in-between one, and I think I've heard it more since we've done the podcast than I had in the last 10 years.
Huh. Now, yeah. I've got a quick question for you, Nick, that's off topic. I know what your bottom is. What's your second-to-last worst?
Let me see. Second-to-last, I believe, is because of the expansion of the list. It's the For Your Eyes Only song by Sheena Easton, followed very closely by the Louis Armstrong, because it's... hasn't aged particularly well.
No.
I'm surprised Sheena Easton was that low.
I mean, like, near it were, like, Lonnie Hall from Never Say Never Again, because it sounds so derivative of everything else, and it sounds so hard to be a Bond song that it sounds like an audition tape. But, you know, but then near the bottom are things like the Sam Smith song and the two Shirley Bassey songs. But I mean, again, we're also talking about things that are generally pretty good, so I'm kind of biased there.
What's everyone's thought about All Time High, Rita Coolidge?
I hear the saxophone in the first 5 seconds, and I'm just like, nope, not for me.
That almost made my list.
It's number eight for me.
Yeah.
You know, it's near the top. I like it because. How do you have a 1980, or what, this is... 83. How do you have an 83 song without saxophone?
Yeah. Like, George Michael could have been just rocking it there.
Yeah. I mean,
why couldn't George Michael or Wham to do it? That would have been interesting.
Well, they got Duran Duran. That's kind of close.
Yeah. I mean, I practically hear Bill Clinton playing the solo riff just to make sure he gets laid that night. You know, I love the song in a way. It just feels so cocaine rolled up sleeves and sunglasses to me. I don't hate it. It's just I feel the same way about the Sam Smith song in a way. Okay, so Writings on the Wall for Spectre seems so 2015 to me that in 10 years it's going to be a joke.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's the Rita Coolidge song to me, where it seems so 1980s in a way that even A-ha and Duran Duran managed to avoid, that it's going to be a forgettable night. Is it 2016? Maybe 2016 song. And Sam Smith is fine. He's talented. He even is almost right there. But it just seems like this one's going to age so poorly.
Yeah.
You know?
I was more impressed listening to it again that All Time High was decent, considering how bad the movie was, that yeah. It was surprisingly good.
Yeah.
It's just one of those ones that, I don't know, there's like a few go-to Bond themes that I listen to, and that's just never made the cut. So I'll hear that coming up, and it's like, why don't I move on to the other ones that I know I like?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Maybe it's just all on me.
Yeah, fair enough.
I don't think you're wrong.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just thinking, like, because we didn't talk about Gladys Knight either, and it's just in between, there's a lot of forgettable ones.
Yeah, Gladys Knight one is a horrible one. Yeah, License to Kill is just I did not like that song at all.
Yeah. You know, and Shirley Bassey appears here 3 times, so we kind of each picked our favorite, but they're very similar.
Yeah.
You know, Tina Turner and... Gladys, like, Tina Turner and Sheryl Crow to me are in the same vocal range, so they're similar, and I'm not opposed to either of them, but, like, the weird thing about Jack White and Alicia Keys is they make each other's voices sound the same, which is baffling. The only thing looking at this list is I really do hope they bring Adele back, but they're just not gonna.
No.
You know?
Who do you think they'll bring back? They'll bring in for the next one? Is it somebody we've already heard of, or is it somebody that's just getting started in the UK and will get a number one hit in a couple years?
That's a great question.
Really good question.
Okay, so we know so far that Daniel Craig is definitely returning, and it's supposed to come out in, like, a year and a half. Is that right?
Yeah, 2019, somewhere in there.
And so Daniel Craig will be the longest-running Bond. He'll be a slightly older guy. I mean, he'll still be in incredible shape, but I don't know. What do you guys think?
They've been all over the map with the other Daniel Craig ones, Chris Cornell, Jack White, Adele, and now Sam Smith, that it's hard to say. Because
yeah.
None of them are really like each other.
No, they're not. Go ahead, Daniel.
I wouldn't be surprised if they got somebody who's popular in the UK, but not as like a pop singer, like, what's her name? Catherine Jenkins. Remember her, John, if you've seen that Doctor Who Christmas special that she was on?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. She was okay. I'm partial to Ellie Goulding, but I know she won't go anywhere, but she would be an interesting choice.
Oof.
Yeah.
I'm torn because, like, for example, there's a band I like from Alabama called the Alabama Shakes.
Yeah.
They sang that song Hold On, you know? And I don't think they'd be a good band, but the lead singer, Brittany Howard, has that low, bassy voice that I think they could do well. And frankly, I just hope that they go back to the old format where the guy who's writing the score, the lady who's writing the score, writes the song so that it fits, so that you can have those beats throughout, you know? Because, I mean, I would love someone like an Alison Krauss or someone to do a kind of bluesy ballad, but I just want it to fit in more. You know, I think that's the kind of thing that makes it eternal. You know, it doesn't matter if it's Live and Let Die or Goldfinger or whatever the ones we chose. What makes it land is the fact that you hear the little riff from The Spy Who Loved Me over and over again, you know.
Exactly.
You know,
it just kind of fit in with the overall score.
Exactly. And it doesn't matter to me then if it's Macklemore or Zac Brown or Justin Bieber. If it fits the movie, it means a lot more. And I think that's why the Adele song worked, because not only was it big and brassy and she has a powerful voice, but they used the theme throughout, and so that it had all the more, it seemed to have more emphasis near the end, so you remembered it more.
Definitely.
I'm surprised that they haven't done what they did with Goldeneye, which is like hire somebody from a different band to write it and then hire a singer to sing it, because I'm thinking somebody like Tom York could come up with an interesting Bond theme, but then get a female singer to do the song, and that I think would be interesting.
Yeah,
it would.
I don't
be.
Disagree.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I mean, since we're coming up to our time, I'll just quickly give my worst, and that was Duran's Duran View to a Kill. Not worst, Guilty Pleasure. Sorry, Guilty Pleasure.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, A View to a Kill by Duran Duran. That it's so 80s, it's got to be fun. And it can't not be. And like you said at when we discussed it earlier, that the opening riff is just, it hooks you, and it doesn't let go. And it's so 80s, it hurts. Like, it could be in a Goonies song, it's so good.
Totally.
Yeah. Unless we have anything else to say, we can go ahead and close this up. Since we've already hit the what should come next, I guess we don't really need to revisit that. But thank you, guys. I think we gave good examples of Bond overall, as well as what not to do for the next Bond. So the Broccoli Family and Eon... Was it Eon Productions? Or is it...
Yeah.
Yeah? That I hope they're listening. And
send us money if you are.
Oh, yes. Definitely send us money. That's care of me in Mission Briefing. And I'll make sure that the other guys get it. But thank you, Nick. Thank you, Daniel. And I guess real quickly, give a plug for future podcasts that you guys are doing. You both have stuff coming in. Daniel, you first.
Well, and I know Nick's going to laugh when I say this, but I promise you, Disremembered is coming. We've got some episodes in the can, and we've got some interesting ideas coming up soon. There'll be the Stories Behind Your Childhood, where I delve into the making of some of your favorite moments. So be on the lookout for that.
Hi, this is Nick here. I am on Myopia Defend Your Childhood and the host, and we have a bunch of stuff on Dude Letter Podcasting, so go to dudeletter.com. But also I was going to plug, since it's not there, I do a history podcast. We just wrapped up our first season. It's called Doomed to Repeat, and we have some good stuff there on the anti-vaccination movement, on sanctuary cities, on Russia. And at the moment, too many academics are listening and not enough people who can tell academics they're full of crap. So listen to Doomed to Repeat. It's really good, and we're looking at everything from Frankenstein to conspiracy theories next season.
Very good. Very good. All right. Well, thank you, guys. And this has been the first episode of my hosting of Mission Briefing. So I hope you enjoyed it and look forward to future things where we will be discussing all things James Bond and maybe a few things not quite James Bond. So thank you for listening, and good night.